Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 1986, three kids at Oberlin College formed a band. For the next 4 years, Bitch Magnet would streak across the pop music sky like a rocket, enthralling millions of fans and making tons of gold records, and actually, they didn't do any of that. Bitch Magnet played in skanky dives and hardcore clubs, sold a handful of records, and then split up. I never heard of them, and you probably didn't either. But in 2011, Bitch Magnet was talked into reuniting by one of the UK's big music festivals, and people showed up to see them. The band's improbable story is part of an even larger story of a musical underground that most of us never see. Guitarist John Fine recounts the tale in his memoir called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution But Can No Longer Hear. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Great to be here, John.
So I want to kind of use your title as a framing device for our conversation today. Let's start with Your Band Sucks. This part of the title actually comes from one of your flyers.
Well, it comes from a Bitch Magnet flyer that the bassist and singer Siyoung Park actually made. But in truth, we stole the title. The title, as I'm sure everyone listening will immediately recognize, was the B-side of a thrown-up 7-inch.
Of course.
Yes, absolutely. The entire lyrics of which are, Your Band Sucks.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, you know, one of the kind of refreshing things about your book is you are not shy about telling us which bands you think suck. Some of them way more famous than your band ever was.
Oh, for sure.
Is there a correlation between one's popularity and one's suckiness?
You know, I wouldn't be quite as binary about it as that. I mean, I don't think it's even worth debating that bands like AC/DC and Led Zeppelin are just among the greatest cultural artifacts of the past 50 years. And by the way, if you do want to argue that, like, argue with me and I will argue you into the ground about it because you're wrong. But I think what you're getting at is, you know, as an underground forms, there's sort of a leveling effect, if I'm not mixing a metaphor. And, you know, there aren't any expectations that anything's going to get huge. But obviously, as time goes on, like, different bands come in, the initial idea changes. It becomes less oppositional, really.
Well,
and the sort of the bands that kind of played into that, that's correct, I'm not fond of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to name names. You want me to name names?
Well, you know, as we get into things, when we get into the whole reunion thing, the Pixies... You're slagging on the Pixies pretty hard by the end of the book.
Well, it was, but seriously, I think the Pixies are, you know, tremendously overrated. The way they
did you think that in the 90s?
Absolutely, yeah.
Really?
I thought that in the 90s, and I thought that in the 80s when they first came out.
Okay.
And when they first came out, it was one of those moments where, if you were really into the subculture, you know, you saw this band and people were starting to like it, and you were like, no, this is not actually what we're about. Like, this is significantly less adventurous.
Everything is gonna burn. We'll all take turns. I'll get my.
And yet they're getting a lot of mainstreamish attention for being adventurous. Like, what about Bastard? What about Rifle Sport? What about 80 other bands that I could name right now that are actually better? But, you know, this is the way it goes. I fully understand how subcultures, like, bleed into the mainstream, and that's what happened here. But it was a drag when it happened.
All right. So that gets me to the next part of your title. Again, we're talking about John Fine's book, Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution But Can No Longer Hear. The phrase indie rock. So... alternative rock, underground rock, you know, there's all these. So let's define our terms here as you see it in this book.
I spent a few years writing this book, and honestly, I still can't define it. And in the introduction of the book, I kind of throw up my hands and say, look, I, you know, I gotta say indie rock, even though my conception of what indie rock is different from what indie rock is now. Indie rock is now on car commercials. It's slightly fey. It's like, you know, somewhat sparse. It's jangly. You know, to me, indie rock in the 80s was, you know, oppositional, aggressive, like weird, really weird. Like, you know, you would go to a Butthole Surfer show and really crazy stuff happened. You know, I mean, there were insane clips playing behind them. There were people dancing naked. I mean, it was this unbelievable assault. I was really into that. I was really into the bands that were, you know, here's an amazing rock record, and actually it has nothing to do with the blues. I mean, here are a bunch of teenagers making records in multiple time signatures. Like, you can't hear the vocals on half of it. It's unbelievably evocative and beautiful. It sounds like nothing else. To me, that's indie rock. You know, maybe underground's a better term. I don't know. Yeah. I called it punk rock a lot, too, but when I say punk rock now, people think, oh, yeah, The Clash. I'm like, no, not The Clash. I don't really care for The Clash. It was this
Ooh,
other
now,
thing.
Those are fighting words. Hey, I know you say it in the book.
If you want, again, I'm happy to go there. the Clash sound like Bruce Springsteen to me. I mean, they really do. And Joe Strummer.
Early Clash?
Yeah.
Safe European Home?
Yeah. I mean, it sped up. I mean, look, I mean, if I guess my thing is this. I'm not really enthralled by rock music that still thinks it has to be rooted in the 50s. Or, you know, I mean, despite what I've said about Led Zeppelin blues traditions, I mean, to me, Led Zeppelin got interesting. Well, two things. To me, Led Zeppelin was interesting because they were trying to play the blues and basically they screwed up. They couldn't do it. And two, like, I don't want to hear Led Zeppelin try to do a blues song. I want to hear Kashmir, you know. I want to hear In the Light. I would much rather hear them play with British folk tradition than have them screw up American blues. I'd rather have them screw up British folk tradition. Beautiful rock music.
Right.
You know, big.
So when you guys, when the three of you, you and Soo Young and Orestes, still students at Oberlin, got together and formed Bitch Magnet, what did you think you were doing?
My ambition was to be in a hardcore band. I wanted to play really fast. I was 18 years old. I had not really gotten a great deal of attention from the opposite sex. I was angry. I mean, this is what you did. You kind of have this really tensed up sort of feeling and you want to get it out somehow. Luckily, I blundered into a band with this gentleman, Soo Young Park, who it turns out had could really play bass, had excellent songwriting skills, and like he had the same idea, but like we were gradually moving in a different direction. I was way behind. You know, once Orestes joined, it was clear I was way behind Soo Young and Orestes in terms of ability. They tolerated me. they also threw me out at one point. but you know, when I look at the scope of it, I mean, I learned a lot from those guys. Look, I got really lucky. I was 18-year-old. I didn't know what the hell I was doing with any of this or anything. And I looked into, honestly, one of the great rhythm sections in rock music. And I stand behind that. I mean, Orestes Morfine is one of the great drummers. Nobody knows this, but I'm serious. Listen to the Bitch Magnet song, Joan of Arc. Watch any live clip he does. The man is a master. You want a drummer who, when they play solo, they sound like they're playing a song. Like, what he's doing is not just beautiful rhythmically and groove, like it sounds like a song. There's a melody to it. I mean, it's an amazing gift.
All right. Well, since you suggested it, why don't we listen to some of Joan of Arc? The band is Bitch Magnet. The guitarist, John Fine, who is also the author of the new book called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution but Can No Longer Hear. And here's his band. We'll be right back. That's a little bit of Joan of Arc from the band Bitch Magnet, recorded, this would have been, John, back in the late 80s?
That would be 1989.
Okay. The band that featured John Fine on guitar, and John's book is called Your Band Sucks. It's his new memoir. Very often, who stuck with a band or stayed in the community or not, very often those things were not choices. They were determined by outside forces. You had obstacles, you overcame them, but then you left anyway, for a while at least. Why?
I had to leave financially because the way I was living my life wasn't working. There's a scene in the book where my girlfriend at the time basically made me list my debts. I was a freelance writer. I was making a pitiful amount of money. I would write a 1,000-word piece on, obscure 70s hard rock bands that would take me a week and I'd get paid $100. That's not the way you can survive in New York City. I had to do it. There was a financial gun at my head. But also, I mean, I don't want to overstate this, but my heart was really broken. The band that I had put together in the 90s, as I say, all right, it didn't work out. Mm-hmm. Like, we went nowhere.
Well, there were two of them. There was
This is the band Vineland.
Vineland. Okay.
And like, there was other stuff around the edges, but like I just couldn't envision doing this again. I was kind of exhausted. I was kind of heartbroken. I was defeated. I mean, and I think there's a temptation when people leave something that they imply that they're maturing or growing up. And like, if someone wants to throw that at me, I'll take it. But it did not feel like maturing. It felt like defeat. Mm. It felt like a huge loss. It felt like I said, I failed. I can't do this.
Well, now that I mentioned earlier that I was going to use your rather lengthy full title to the book as a framing device, and this gets us to the next part of it. Again, John Fine's book is Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution, but can no longer hear. So the failure of this revolution, the revolution was hoped to be what, to tear down the edifice of major record labels and the big arena stars?
That was my hope. It was a very naive hope. But what was very exciting in the 80s and 90s was to watch the coming together, the blossoming of this entire parallel music industry. Bands of our size, maybe we sold 10,000 records worldwide. There was enough of infrastructure. You could tour, you could record, you could do band things. Mm-hmm. On an international level. And I thought that this thing would replace the other thing. This is, as anyone who's studied the history of business and or culture, is an incredibly naive belief. Like, revolutions don't happen like that. The big incumbent major labels or the big incumbent institutions don't just say, oh my God, you're right, we suck, we quit, we're leaving. Like, we're going to empty out all this lovely real estate in Los Angeles and New York City. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So on that level, it failed. But as I hope I make clear in the book, that was a naive hope. Where it didn't fail, and this is actually, to me, probably the more important point, this circuit still exists. There have been generations of bands that come through it. There is this idea, which wasn't there when I was 16 years old and a clueless, high school student in suburban New Jersey. There's this idea that if you're 16, you can be in a weird band like this. You can do stuff. You can find an audience. When I was 16, I had no idea. I was just like, wow, everyone hates me, and I guess I'm an idiot. And I don't want to understate that. That's incredibly powerful. Like, there was a place in the world for people like this, for bands like this.
Well, although this book is very much your story and the story of your band, you did a lot of interviews with a lot of your colleagues who form a kind of collective Greek chorus, commenting on your journey and Bitch Magnet and all that kind of stuff.
I was curious to hear their stories because I don't think – to me it feels like this book is really the tale of this movement, of whatever you want to call it, for 30-some-odd years. And, I witnessed a tiny slice of it. Mm-hmm. You start layering in people from bands that people have heard of, like Jesus Lizard, Dinosaur Jr., Mission to Burma, and it makes it bigger. Bands like Mudhoney makes it bigger. But at the same time, I wanted to hear from the people that had to make a certain decision. I'm 35 years old. I've never had a job. My band is paying me $700 a month. Like, we've maxed out. It's not getting any bigger than this. What the fuck do I do?
Right.
And like, to me, that's really compelling. That story hasn't really been told.
Well, one of the voices that we hear from in the book is the bass player from Pitch Blend.
Yes.
Talking about how there's always the guy.
There is always the guy.
You're talking
no
about
matter
a community.
Where you go. Yeah.
There's always that guy who
will come
to your show and will bring you back home and let you sleep on the floor. And I know that this is still the case.
Still the case.
The metal community still works that way.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. This is the classic, kind of trope of underground music, you know. And you're referring to a section where I basically do a long quote from Scott DeSimon, who is the bassist in a band called Pitchblende. You're on tour. You book a show in Columbia, South Carolina. Like, no one ever comes, but you book it because you always do it. But no matter what town it is, there is always that guy. There's going to be the one guy who's going to be excited to see you. Like, even if there's five people there, there's going to be the one guy who's going to put you up in his house, who's going to either cook you breakfast. Like, maybe it's not great breakfast, but he's cooking you breakfast, you know. He'll tell you, you know, how to get out of town. Like, and he'll make you stay up late watching some, like, crazy weird art movie, like, you know, the Sun Ra movie.
Right.
Which, by the way, you couldn't find that easily in, like, 1992. And you were always finding this guy. You were finding this guy or this woman in Morgantown, West Virginia, Missoula, Montana, you know, Sioux Falls, everywhere.
Yeah.
And that was a beautiful thing. That was a beautiful thing.
So,
and it still is, as you point out.
Right. But did things change when so-called alternative rock or indie rock was suddenly discovered, when Nirvana hits, and then you've got this feeding frenzy of major labels trying to just pluck little obscure bands and, you know, hopefully make millions with them?
Well, we've actually been through a few cycles of that now. It's funny. You see it come around every 10 years or so. There was sort of a major label feeding frenzy again in the early part of last decade. There was a more recent one. As bands like Arcade Fire, mm-hmm. I'm sure they can sell a lot of records while they're still on an indie label, Merge in this case. Was it different? It was different for some of my friends, honestly. I was still in the band that was sleeping on people's floors. But I mean, right. You know, there are people I talked to in the book, like Rose Marshak from the band Poster Children. They signed a major label deal. They were smart about it. They made three records or four records, I can't remember which. They saved enough money from their advances, which bands generally didn't do, to outfit a recording studio in their house.
Right.
They were able to leave that experience more independent than they came in. A band like Melvins, to a degree, had the same thing. On the other hand, there's also the example of, you know, my friends in the band Urge Overkill, who I don't know if anyone remembers anymore, but they have a song in Pulp Fiction.
The Neil Diamond cover.
The Neil Diamond cover,
yeah. Soon.
And for like 6 or 8 months, it looked like they were going to be really huge.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out. And it didn't work out in a really big way, and there were drug problems in the band. And, it's kind of a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
So you were aware of that happening around you. Like, and you were aware of the fact that the band you were seeing at Brownies, that they were a couple of major label reps, and they might be, like, talking to them afterwards. And that was kind of strange around the edges. It didn't really bother me, and honestly, like, those guys were not after my band. Like,
yeah.
Not at all.
Well, but, you know, as you go through the book and you refer to some of the bands that you loved and saw as kind of, you know, great examples of this indie rock community and this subculture, there are certain names that keep cropping up. Slint
yes.
is one of them. You know,
yeah.
A band that seems to have maintained a kind of even keel.
Slint broke up for an extraordinarily long time. They did reform. And they broke up probably when they were going to get big or as big as a band like that could get. They had made their second album, which is called Spiderland, which is the one they'll be remembered for.
Right,
Which is a beautiful album, absolutely majestic album, made by teenagers. And they broke up before it came out. I believe their release date on that was 1991. They didn't tour. That record really grew afterwards. I mean, I don't have the exact figures. It wouldn't surprise me if it sold 100,000 copies at this point, which is indie multi-platinum.
That's really, yeah.
But right. as I mentioned in the book, I saw Slint twice while they were a band, once when Bitch Magnet played with them, tiny audiences. The next time I saw them was on their first reunion tour. They sold out Irving Plaza, which is a venue in New York City that holds approximately 1,000 people. Slint played less than 30 shows when they were an active band. The total, the crowd at Irving Plaza was probably larger than the aggregate audience of people who'd seen them beforehand.
Yeah.
Theirs is an unusual story, but people remembered. Like, people really held on to this stuff, and it was lovely.
Let's hear a little bit from that band Slint, and actually this is the opening track from that
what a
great
beautiful
record
song.
Of 1991 called
what a beautiful song.
Breadcrumb Trail.
I said okay, sat down, and I thought about it for a minute, asked her if she'd rather go on the road with us instead.
That is the band Slint and a song called Breadcrumb Trail. They are a band mentioned several times in John Fine's new book called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution But Can No Longer Hear. When did Slint reunite?
Slint reunited in the mid-2000s. I want to say 2005, but you should really double-check me on that.
But the point is, it's before the real big wave of... I mean, I guess Pixies reunite sort of around that time.
Well, so if we want to look at the history of bands reuniting, I think if you go back to the 80s, you have bands like Stiff Little Fingers and Wire getting back together.
Right.
Wire probably being the first, very important band. Honestly, the first band of this generation to reunite was Mission to Burma. They got back together completely out of the blue, shocking everyone, for shows in New York and Boston in 2002. That turned into a second career. Then there's gradually a wave growing. You have a festival in the UK called All Tomorrow's Parties that started kind of fomenting this sort of thing. They
right.
realized it would be a bigger event if they got bands back together. And, you know, in a lot of cases, the audiences for these bands had grown, which is kind of amazing.
That is the amazing thing. I mean, as you say, you know, Slint may have played to, in one evening in New York, may have played to more people than they had played in all of their 30 shows when they were an active band
Absolutely.
First time around.
Absolutely.
What about for you guys, All Tomorrow's Parties, for you guys in Bitch Magnet, All Tomorrow's Parties calls in 2011 and says, we want you. What did you think?
We were actually... The idea came from Ian Williams from the band Battles, who Battles was the band curating this. And his wife actually suggested it during a dinner we were all at. And Ian and I kind of looked at each other. I mean, at that point, our records were going to be reissued and there was something brewing. What did I think? I wanted to do it really badly. I was not at all sure I could sell it to the other guys in the band, particularly Sue Young. Luckily, as the book tells, the night that we actually set up a conference call with another person to kind of chime in. And the night we called Soo Young, it was nighttime for him because he's in Singapore. He was out at a pub and he was a few pints into it. So he was pliable. He was really excited. And I didn't realize until much later that, like, I read an interview with him. He was like, yeah, they kind of caught me when my defenses were down. I was like, oh, hey, whatever it takes.
Whatever man. It takes.
Whatever
yeah.
it takes.
But did you expect, I mean, you know, were you hoping for a Slint kind of thing where everyone who had ever seen your band first time around now suddenly all came to one place at one time to watch?
We were somewhat different than Slint in that we toured more extensively, and we had done well in Europe. Like, you know, the last time we went through, like, we played to, like, 1,000 people or so in London. So, you know, for a band like us, that's, you know, that's selling out Madison Square
yeah,
Garden 16
absolutely.
Times. But you have no idea. You have no idea who's going to remember. You have no idea if anyone's going to care. But people showed up. Now, I want to be clear. Like, in terms of how most people consider a successful rock band will have a successful reunion show. Like, you know, 200 people packed into a pub in London that's oversold. Like, that's probably not what they have in mind. Like, they're probably thinking like Foghat on the State Fair. And yeah, and by the way, more power to that. This wasn't that. But it's an incredibly, I can't talk about it without being sort of sappy. I mean, it was incredibly moving. Yeah. People remembered. You have no idea. You have no idea. It had been a long time. We had no contact with these people.
Just to be clear, when you say you have no idea, you really mean I, John Fine, had no idea.
The person playing this band, yeah, has no idea if people are going to remember. You, the person playing this band, has no idea if people are still going to care. You have no idea. You, the person in this band, has no idea if people who weren't there the first time are going to show up. That happened for bands like Dinosaur Jr. and Mission to Burma. Kind of didn't happen for us, but that's fine.
Yeah. The folks who were there the first time around were there again for these reunion.
Yeah, there was
tours.
One guy in London who came up to me and said that he hadn't seen us in London the first time around because his parents didn't let him go.
And was it in the Philippines? Was it in the Philippines that someone comes up to you with a copy of your first private released LP?
Actually, in both. That was in Taiwan and Singapore. Like, someone, we had pressed 1,000 copies of our first record, and that sold out quickly in America. And, you know, some guy shows up 25 years later.
In the 7,000 miles away.
In Hong Kong. In the case of Hong Kong, it was a gentleman who'd flown in from Taiwan, couldn't speak English, and just sort of hands this thing to us, and someone translated it. It's amazing, you know, and you were constantly confronted with things like that. You're talking about a scene in Manila. We met this guy named Diego Castillo, who's in a pretty big Filipino band called Sandwich. And, you know, we're in his living room. He's showing off all his indie rock records. And he had to explain what it took to get those records in the 90s in Manila, which is you find American cash, which isn't that easy. You send it, like, send enough for the record and then a bunch more for shipping. You don't even know what, and a really nice note, and hope that something comes back. And not everybody sent something back.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, this is a process that takes a few months. And, I mean, it was incredible to see what people went through for that. Now, of course, everything's on the internet.
Which is a good thing, as you point out.
Which is absolutely a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated thing when we talk about the changing business model, but I think net-net, it's good for bands like this.
We're talking about bands like Bitch Magnet, like Slint, like Mission of Burma.
Bands that very few have ever actually heard of, but you should have.
Although
hopefully.
Mission of Burma, you know.
We hope you've heard
of. Yeah, they had a kind of a profile. And since we've mentioned them a bunch of times, I want to play a little track, just in case folks haven't heard them before. That's How I Escaped My Certain Fate is the name of this track. Band Mission of Burma for my guest John Fine and his band Bitch Magnet. They were already on the underground scene when you guys formed in 1986. They were among the first to begin this wave of reunions, John, back in 2002. That song called That's How I Escaped My Certain Fate, it almost seems like a certain fate for musicians who play loud music, that there's going to be a hearing issue. And Roger Miller of Mission of Burma has told us on Soundcheck in the past about, you know, his battle with tinnitus or tinnitus.
I'm glad you don't know how to pronounce it either, by the way.
It's actually supposed to be tinnitus.
Yeah, but who wants to say
that?
One wants to say that.
So this brings me to the last part of your book's title. Your band sucks, what I saw at Indie Rock's failed revolution, but can no longer hear. What has happened to you? What have you done for your art? What have you sacrificed for your music?
My ears are not what they once were. You know, like many young musicians, particularly when I was getting into it, I was not at all attentive to what, sustained exposure to guitar feedback at 120 decibels, you know, can do to you. I have tinnitus of a moderate form. I have mild hearing loss. I notice it. As did a lot of people that I spoke with for the book, I notice it when I'm in a noisy bar, a noisy restaurant. It is a occupational hazard. You know, like basketball players have bad knees. Tennis players have a forearm that's three times the size of the other, and their elbow may not be so great if they're doing a one-handed backhand, although I guess no one is anymore. Musicians have problems with their ears, some more than others. Amazingly, as I basically asked everyone that I spoke to for this book, around 60 people from this milieu, how are your ears? And a lot of them said okay. And I've been to their shows, and those were loud goddamn shows. And yeah. A lot of people, they didn't want to wear earplugs, which is not something I can really recommend at this point.
Yeah. But, you know, when people say my ears are okay, that says to me, you haven't been to an audiologist. Because I was one of those people who just said, yeah, my ears, if I hear everything, you don't know what you're not. You
except
don't hear
for the
what
20%
you're
not hearing.
And you do kind of think, you know, when you're in a restaurant or a bar, why is it suddenly, I didn't used to have this problem.
Gotta lean in really far, you know, gotta cup your ear a little bit. I'm pretty sanguine about that. I have friends who have really severe tinnitus, and it's a painful thing. With me, it's a mild annoyance. Honestly, you know, this is, you know, don't tell the children. The trade-off is worth it. The transformative experiences associated with performance and really extreme sound, I wouldn't trade that for anything. I mean, they were hallucinogenic. They were sexual. They were these really intense physical sensations that I'm really glad I experienced. I don't regret it. That's really all I can say.
And that is kind of where you leave us at the end of the book. The book by John Fine is called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution But Can No Longer Hear. John, a real pleasure speaking with you today.
A blast. Great talking with you, John.
Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.